Translation, as far as my daughter-in-law Kunti is concerned, upon the great general Pandu's death, she became a widow with many children, and therefore she suffered greatly. And when you were grown up, she suffered a great deal also because of your actions. Purport, Maitreya Prabhupada. The sufferings of Kunti Devi are doubly lamented. She suffered greatly because of early widowhood and to get her minor children brought up in the royal family. And when her children were grown up, she continued to suffer because of her son's actions. So her sufferings continued. This means that she was destined to suffer by providence, and this one has to tolerate without being disturbed. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadam Maiham Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeyaham Shri Guru Shri Uta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamsya Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tvam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrinda Vaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhavacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. I'll just read the purport again because there's some interesting points that come from this. The sufferings of Kunti Devi are doubly lamented. She suffered greatly because of early widowhood and to get her minor children brought up in the royal family because there was so much intrigue and intrigue going on in the palace and conspiring against them. And when her children were grown up, she continued to suffer because of her son's actions. Here Bhishma Devi is speaking to Yudhishthira Maharaj and he's saying that she continued to suffer when you were grown up because of your actions. It's an interesting point because how can she suffer because of Yudhishthira's actions? So her sufferings continued. This means that she was destined to suffer by providence. Again, an interesting point. How does providence interfere with karma, one's own karma, which we normally attribute to suffering? And this one has to tolerate without being disturbed. This idea that some sufferings we try and mitigate against, we try and act against, and some sufferings we just have to tolerate because we're not going to be able to fix them. So today is also the auspicious disappearance day of Jayananda Prabhu. So I'll try and refer to some stories and examples from his incredible life in the context of this. Because he was, again, a wonderful example of how one should see from the spiritual perspective this idea of what looks externally to be like suffering. So, okay. So, again, just the... I know that you've been going through the verses, but just to the context of this, after the war, Yudhishthira Maharaj is completely overwhelmed with this... feeling of despondency that so many people have died due to this war, which he feels responsible for. And so Krishna tells him to take instructions from Bhishma Dev, and he does that. So he goes to Bhishma Dev, and Bhishma Dev is speaking to him. And here these points are being made. Now, there's both an external meaning of Bhishma Dev's words here and an internal meaning, and we'll try and discuss both of them. Because just from an external perspective, it may be a little bit confusing because of some of the points we've made, but we'll get into the detail. So this leads to the question that what causes pure devotees to suffer? This point is being made to by Bhishma Dev that your mother suffered. Specifically here, he's talking about your mother. He's talking about him. And then in this particular verse, he's talking about Kunti Devi. So Kunti Devi, we know, is such an exalted personality. So what causes pure devotees to suffer? So that question comes up. And that obviously leads us to the next question, which is, what causes practicing devotees to suffer? Because that must be different to what causes pure devotees to suffer. And then, of course, the question is, what causes people who are not devotees to suffer? So these points are expressed in these different versions in different places, and we'll try and cover some of these areas. So as we know, when Sanatana Goswami meets Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for instructions, his first question is, who am I? But the second question is, why do I suffer? Right? And his point is, after, and his like third point on that, so first is, who am I? Second is, why do I suffer? And the third one is that, without knowing this, i.e. without knowing who I am and why I suffer, how can I be benefited? Like, how can I possibly be benefited unless I know these things? And of course, they're both related to each other. The reason why we suffer is because we don't know who I am. Right? That's the connection that's in within that context of Sanatana Goswami's questions to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So normally when we talk about the position of suffering when we're talking to preaching about Krishna consciousness, and when we typically think about the context of suffering, we think about it in the context of karma. So I perform some kind of bad action, some sinful action, and I get a reaction to that, and that's my karma, and therefore there's suffering, right? So that's the usual way of understanding it. And here Bhishma Dev is differentiating that. And also he's bringing into this idea of providence, this idea of providence, which we understand to be the nature of the material world. So in the previous purport, he says, previous purport, Srila Prabhupada says, as long as a person is fully in cooperation with the wishes of the Lord, one has no cause for despondency, however trying the circumstances of life. And Bhishma Dev wanted to impress this upon him. But normally, so there's this idea of sin, but within that context, there's this nature of the material world. And, you know, the five topics of the Gita that Krishna gives us include, besides the jiva and God, include these three aspects of time, karma, and the material nature. And this time, karma, and material nature, they essentially comprise, if you like, the system of the material world. That's what the material world is produced of, in terms of those are the rules of the game. That we have karma, we have material nature, which is essentially the modes of material nature, and we have time. And the combination of these three things creates a system within which the jiva acts. And then God is obviously there as the overseeing principle. So these ideas of the gunas, time, combined with this idea of karma, to give an example, like how does the mode of ignorance lead to suffering? Because there's one thing that I'm doing a sinful act. For that sinful act, I'm getting a reaction. That's clear, as in it's straightforward. But there are some things that just being in the material world is causing reaction, is causing some suffering. And this is because we're in the context of time and the modes of material nature. So even as we understand from Nectar of Devotion, even the acts of piety cause suffering, right? So it's not just sinful acts. Of course, from a devotee's perspective, from a materialist perspective, sinful act means those things which transgress religious rules. So that which transgresses dharma is sinful from a materialist perspective. But from a devotee's perspective, anything that detracts from Krishna, you know, within the codes of dharma or outside of the codes of dharma, that's sinful. You understand the distinction, right? So therefore these different things cause us to be bound within the material world. And therefore we keep going around in this system created of these three elements that Krishna has told us about in the Gita. Okay. So that's kind of the standard way of explaining for somebody who's not practicing Krishna consciousness, the causes of suffering, right? So that's how we usually explain it, because that's how Krishna gives it to us in the Gita in a simple form. But the Pandavas are different, obviously, right? The Pandavas are pure devotees. Every act they did as a as an act of devotion for Krishna. Everything, and who, you know, what personalities we're speaking about. Kunti Devi, whose prayers are there within the Bhagavatam. Draupadi, whose acts of surrender are famous, kind of, you know, as the turning point of the Mahabharata. Arjuna, whom Krishna, you know, so like, these are unbelievably exalted personalities, yet they suffered. Yet they suffered. So then the question arises in scripture that why is that? And therefore, Bhishma Devi is giving this, as I said, both the external reason and the internal reason. External reason he's attributing to time and providence and these things, and his actions, Yudhishthira's actions. And we'll see how that is both externally true and internally true. Externally true. Brihad Bhagavatamrita is described that devotees, so now we're talking about devotees, okay, so like exalted devotees. Those devotees encounter two types of danger, which means two types of troubling circumstances. One of them, and I'll just read it out, one, Sanatana Goswami explains, one is created by Krishna to glorify his devotees. Okay, so one created by Krishna to glorify his devotees, that we understand too, also, because we've heard that. And the second, which was new to me, I hadn't thought of this before. The second, stimulated by the devotees when they are intensely anxious to see him. So when the devotee becomes intensely anxious to see Krishna, which means the performance of devotional service, it causes a type of danger, like a troubling circumstance. Why is that? Because they're essentially taking some kind of risk for Krishna. They, by their own volition, are taking steps towards Krishna, which creates a circumstance because that's the way the world is created. But this act creates, or rather attracts Krishna's special blessings. So just like this idea of, the example was of when Sudama and Krishna performed so many, you know, like they were told to go and get the firewood. So then after they were found later, Sanipani Muni gives him his blessing. He said, because you took so much trouble, I give you all my blessings. Like there was this interaction. So in the same way, when the pure devotee acts for Krishna in this way, then Krishna reciprocates. And of course, we see this example played out within all pure devotees, including the life of Jayananda Prabhu. So, you know, like you can imagine his circumstance when he was reaching out or taking this intense, like I read it again, stimulated by devotees when they are intensely anxious to see him. So when the devotee becomes intensely anxious to see Krishna, then the circumstances around that arise, which appear at least externally to be very troubling. So in Yudhishthira's context, by his devotion to Krishna, he led. So this is where this internal aspect comes, by your actions, Bhishma is saying, right? So what actions of Yudhishthira could he be attributing to this suffering? So from an internal perspective, those acts were, he did everything as an act for Krishna, just like the Rajasuya Yagya. Yudhishthira did the Rajasuya Yagya is performed when an emperor wants to establish his rule over the entire planet. That is when the Rajasuya Yagya is performed. Just like Lord Ram performed the Rajasuya Yagya. So then, Yudhishthira performed that yagya, but why did he do it? Did he want to establish his, his dominance or his proprietorship over the entire world? He did it, Prabhupada explains in the Krishna book, when I first read this, Srila Prabhupada's explanation for this, I wasn't practicing Krishna consciousness at the time, and I thought, you know, Srila Prabhupada's making an excuse for the acts of Yudhishthira Maharaj because it must be it's such a materialistic thing to perform the Rajasuya Yagya. And Prabhupada says there that he performed the Rajasuya Yagya because he didn't want people to think that devotees of Krishna suffer. He thought if worldly people think that, oh, look at the life of the Pandavas, they suffered so much. He said, if worldly people think like that, they'll lose faith in Krishna because they'll think, just look at the Pandavas, they're devotees of Krishna, look what happened to them. So he said, let it be established that the devotees of Krishna receive benefits which are completely different to the materialist, and they are permanent. So he performed the Rajasuya Yagya as a devotional act to establish Krishna consciousness. That was his motive. And whilst I was thinking that Prabhupada was kind of covering up for Yudhishthira Maharaj, this is explained later on in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, that this was Yudhishthira Maharaj's motivation, actually. So in this way, and then obviously to the point of war, where Yudhishthira Maharaj goes to war. So these acts are leading to what looks externally like trouble or troubling situations. So so like that, Yudhishthira Maharaj's acts in this context lead to that situation. So, but what is the result of that? The result of that went through, and then Yudhishthira Maharaj's despondency now. So he went through the war. Rajasya Yajna was performed. The Rajasya Yajna was like a tipping point in terms of the decision to go to war, because Duryodhan becomes so disturbed by that that it was beyond the point of no return after that. So that led to the war. And then after the war, Yudhishthira Maharaj becomes so despondent, and then he seeks this advice from Bhishma Dev. So Bhishma Dev is actually responding to all of this chain of events that's happened. And what happens from that? That the world learns the glory of both Yudhishthira Maharaj and his actions, even though he went through that suffering, and his response to the suffering. How does a pure devotee respond to that type of situation? How did Kunti Devi respond to that type of situation? So this is how it glorifies the devotees, like we were talking about. One is created by Krishna to glorify his devotee, right? That was the first reason. So in this way, Krishna is being, the devotee is being glorified. And for the benefit of the whole world, both the Bhagavad Gita was spoken and Bhishma Dev's instructions to Yudhishthira, as we're hearing now, were spoken, which forms such an important part of the Bhagavatam and, of course, like a huge part of the Mahabharata. So just like it's explained that the nature of a great personality is to suffer so that others will suffer less. So the famous example is Lord Shiva, you know, drinking the poison. But then, of course, you see that played out in the lives of all great devotees, that they take on suffering so that others may suffer less. And this is one example I was thinking about from Jayananda Prabhu's life was, like, he left his body aged 38, or just about to turn 38, or just having turned 38. And, of course, Srila Prabhupada was still on the planet. So there was discussion about how he left and his actions leading up to that point, but he contracted cancer, and when he had cancer, his appetite, his kind of, he couldn't eat or drink, and he was suffering so much, externally suffering so much. And the devotees felt, okay, because he was so into prasad, both distributing prasad, and he used to like prasad. So devotees felt that, okay, how can we, you know, we would ask him what he'd like to eat, like naturally. So they were looking after him. So they said to him, what would you like to eat? They knew that one of his favorite items was cauliflower pakoras. So they asked him, so he said, cauliflower pakoras. So they made cauliflower pakoras. They took it to him in the hospital. Now he couldn't eat, and he knew that he couldn't eat. So they thought they were making it for him. He took the cauliflower pakoras, went up and down the ward in his wheelchair, giving out cauliflower pakoras to the other patients. So this idea that what seems one thing from the outside leads to a result which is different. I am used to a suffering which follows the line of I do something wrong, I get a reaction to what I did, and how that plays out is it manifests as suffering. I don't feel enjoyment from it, nothing good comes out of it. That's my experience. And therefore, sometimes I portray or project, rather, that experience onto the lives of great devotees. But that's not how it works. Like, I am under the shelter of Krishna's external potency. Devotees like Jayananda Prabhu are under the shelter of Krishna's internal potency. That has a different trajectory. Their trajectory is, it looks like suffering on the outside, there's bliss on the inside, and it leads to something good. It's a completely different circumstance and result that happens here. Okay, so here, this coming back to this verse, here the verse Bhishma Devi is talking about how Kunti Devi suffered right from the beginning. Right from the beginning, she had these Pandavas born outside of wedlock. right? So that meant she had to put them in the basket downriver. There was so much suffering, the anxiety of what will society think, etc., etc., etc. And then Pandu died. And then Pandu died. She's having to. She's essentially a single parent. She's trying to raise these kids in a very hostile environment. And then the etc. And then the war, etc. So Bhishma is saying, like, she suffered so much right from the beginning all the way through to now. And even when she was growing up, she didn't have a husband, and therefore she suffered. And now, when she had grown-up children, because then, she would come under the shelter of her grown-up children, even then she wasn't free from suffering because of your actions, speaking to Yudhishthira. So, like, throughout this whole process, when do you think Kunti suffered the most? When do you think she suffered the most? Like, she went through so many things in her life. When do you think that she suffered the most? When the Pandavas were exiled, okay? That was an intense, like, she had nothing. They had to leave for the forest, used to palaces and all the rest of it. What else? Krishna was leaving. Okay. So when Krishna was leaving, I'll read some context here. So Kunti says that when she had no husband, Krishna protected her and her sons. Isn't it? So we know that. So she said, when I had no husband, Krishna protected me. She felt that she received more mercy than even Devaki. Right? Why would she feel that she received more mercy than Devaki? Because Krishna saved Devaki once. They were in the jail. Krishna came, saved them. Krishna saved Kunti Devi and the Pandavas again and again and again. Not only that, but Krishna saved Devaki. He didn't save Devaki's children. In that instance, he didn't save them, of course, after what happened. But for Kunti, she says that he saved me and my sons. So another reason she feels that she's more blessed. And then she says that Devaki had many different people to protect her. First of all, of course, Vasudev, and then others in the family. But Kunti says, I had nobody. I had only Krishna. I had to rely entirely on Krishna. But now, she says, now she doesn't feel this way. Deprived of his sight, she begs that famous prayer, let more calamities come again and again. Right? So, if those other things, the fact that the children were born out of wedlock, the fact that they were exiled, the fact that they had to, the house of lack, and all, like, again and again and again. Or if all of these things were such great calamities and such suffering, why would somebody ask for them again and again? Because there's no suffering. See, like, ultimately, there may be something that's suffering, but there's something that's pleasure. Something that looks like suffering externally is ecstasy for the pure devotee. That's a very difficult concept for us to conceive of because we rarely have that, I rarely have that experience. So, but for the pure devotee who is in touch with Krishna, what looks like suffering actually is bliss. So, why would somebody again and again bring on something if that thing is painful? If that thing is calamitous? Genuinely. So that's why Kunti Devi is praying like this. And this, as it's explained, this is the nature of prema. The very nature of love of God is like this. This has its climax in Vraja Prema, the special, unique, and of course in Vraja Prema has its even heightened exemplification in the gopis of Vraj, where this becomes very clear for us as to how this must be true. Because what seems to be like suffering to an ordinary person, not even to necessarily an ordinary person, even to a devotee who doesn't possess that type of love, what seems to be like suffering for that great devotee is something very wonderful. And we only see a snapshot. Right, so we see a snapshot. We don't see what comes before and after, and we judge it on that snapshot. Just like sometimes we judge karma, right? So like something bad happens to me, I see it in a snapshot. I don't see what I did previously. I don't see what's going to happen after. I judge it, and then therefore I think, well, how is that fair, right? Because I only see this. So in the same way, so now listen to what the Brihad Bhagavatamrita has to say on this. Sanatana Goswami says, only expert rasikas can understand how prema can be pleasurable internally and suffering externally. Only expert rasikas can understand how. Those who are not expert cannot know and should simply accept authority. But if that doesn't convince us, if neophytes insist, they can see that pure devotees do indeed enjoy ecstasy and separation, and since no other cause is evident, the cause must be their intense experience of what appears to be suffering. I.e., this idea that, okay, just believe it. If you can't, either experience it, like a rasika means that person has that experience. Because they have that experience, they know, oh, what appears to be like suffering to me externally, how in my material life I may have seen that as suffering, now that I have a certain level of experience, I can see that giving me the greatest pleasure. Okay, so if we have that experience ourselves, which we all actually to some degree have, but if to the degree that we have it fully, to that degree we can understand how this is true. But if we don't have that experience, then just follow authority because scripture says so. But if you don't want to accept that, then at least understand that how is it that devotees feel this ecstasy, that again and again they're asking for it. So therefore there must be some cause beyond what looks like ordinary suffering, right? And this is why Kunti Devi phrase for more. Okay, so I'm going to okay, so now that's the kind of context for the pure devotees, that these different things are going on the level of prema. And then I was thinking about, like, okay, so how does that apply for, so we've talked about kind of what it looks like for somebody who's not a practicing a devotee, then it's the laws of material nature just playing out. Right? It's karma, it's time, it's the modes of material nature. Those things are playing out. For the highly exalted personalities that we see externally, what looks like suffering, there's something else going on because it's part of Krishna's lila, and there's a reciprocation of prema, and that prema has manifested in a way that looks to me like suffering, but it isn't. So then I was thinking about, okay, how does it apply to practicing devotees who are neither in one end of the spectrum or the other. Because to some degree, like, you know, we are all trying to stop sinful activities. So we've reduced our sinful activities when we come to Krishna consciousness. We're chanting, so we know that chanting removes sinful reactions. So these things are going on. But we're not yet there where we experience viraha bhav and things like this. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda ki jai. Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai. Shri Shri Gonitai ki jai. So what are the causes of this suffering, and how do we see it? And you know, there's the famous narration of when Parikshit Maharaj goes to say, you know, he sees Kali personified hurting the legs of the cow and the bull, and then there's this long conversation between the bull and Parikshit Maharaj, and the nature of that conversation is, who did this? Right? Tell me who did this, and I'll kill them. And the bull is responding, who can say? So who can say? Who can identify what is the cause for this? And it's a really wonderful conversation because it talks to this point. How do you trace back the point of causality in terms of suffering? And this is the example of the banyan tree, the upside down. Who can trace its roots? Who can trace where it starts from, how it leads, all these multi, because it's being driven, you know, Krishna says in that verse, it's being driven, the nourishment of that tree, the water of that tree are the gunas. So as you associate with the gunas, then comes different things, and that goes in a whole load of different ways. Okay, so the three points that came to my mind for our own application is, one is that we are being trained. So whilst on one aspect, the pure devotee is being glorified, for the practicing devotee, that practicing devotee is being trained. So, this is the strictness of Krishna to train the devotee. And even though this appears as karmic reactions, when Krishna is training us, there is a difference. There is a difference between how we can tell there is a difference. There is a way we can tell the difference between when Krishna is training us and when we're suffering just our karma. Okay, how can we tell? And Brihad Bhagavatamrita tells us. What are the four ways in which we can tell? One, that this training, this suffering, these reactions, they do not leave a subtle residue, right? Which is the seed of future karmic reactions. So we know the four stages of karmic reactions, right? From going from bija to prarabdha. So that seed, when we get rid of the manifestation of the sin, but the seed remains. And when the seed remains, that sin occurs again and again and again, and it grows, and it grows in different ways. But when Krishna trains us, that manifestation, what looks like the manifestation of prarabdha karma, actually, the seed is being removed. So that's one important distinction. Second distinction is that the devotee finds great pleasure in these interventions. Okay. Either, this is an interesting one. So, when we are being trained by Krishna, we actually find pleasure in it. Why? Because we reflect on that in the consciousness that this is for my purification. So, this is a, when we are able to reflect on that, we can see that this is Krishna's training for us. So, it leads to pleasure as opposed to pain, ultimately. So obviously aspects of it may be painful for the practicing devotee, but ultimately it's a pleasurable experience. The third reason is that this suffering protects the confidentiality of devotional service from intrusion. This idea that devotional service is a very confidential thing. The fact that Krishna manifests these sufferings for even the practicing devotee means that the confidentiality of devotion, because devotional service requires some level of adhikar to perform it. So to qualify for that, somebody has to go through a process of the strengthening of faith. This is the qualification to begin that process. So to do that, this external manifestation of, oh, if you're a devotee of Krishna, you lose everything, or Krishna takes everything away, or there's some suffering. So therefore, somebody who performs that devotional service, despite that, is growing in their faith. And the fourth reason is that it increases the eagerness with which devotees call upon the Lord to appear, and thus it increases their pleasure when he does. This idea that when we, as devotees who are practicing, are put in these circumstances, it does increase our calling out to Krishna, because we have no other shelter. We're putting ourselves in a situation, as Tribhuvanath Prabhu used to say, we're putting ourselves in a situation where Krishna has no choice but to intervene. Right, we have no other shelter. We're calling out to Krishna. So these four ways I thought were very interesting. So one that kind of encapsulated in this one point, which is we are being trained. Now the second point is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, when Krishna is speaking to Uddhava, that actually there is no way of expertly avoiding suffering. So sometimes there's this idea that, okay, if I get to the level point of goodness, typically it's goodness, or if I manage passion properly, then I'll avoid suffering, because I'll have some enjoyment of passion, and then I just need to keep passion pushing up to goodness, and then I'm good. So then I can have one foot in both worlds, one in the material, one in the spiritual, and I can live a happy life like that. So there's this idea. So then, but Krishna clarifies this point in the 11th canto, and he says, suffering doesn't cease. However we try and manage the material world, however we try and manage the gunas, suffering is not going to stop. Even when you regulate sense gratification. So we have this idea that, okay, people like me are addicted to sense gratification. So because you're addicted, then regulate it. That's the only way you can deal with it. But that doesn't mean that the suffering is going to go away. As soon as you touch the material energy, understand that there will be suffering. So, Krishna gives this example, that it's observed within the material world that sometimes even an intelligent person is not happy. And sometimes even a great fool is happy. So how can it be that careful management of the material and energy can lead to avoidance of suffering? The concept of becoming happy through expertly performing material activities is simply a useless exhibition of false ego. Material life is ambiguous and relative, but even if one knew how to be happy, still the constant threat of death makes the world unenjoyable. This constant fear, whether it manifests explicitly for us, whether we connect that fear to the fact that we're scared of death, or whether it's implicit and we can't make the connection, that is there. It's part of our being. It's wrapped up in our false ego. So that's the second one. And the third one is that we have to maintain the right perspective. So this, I'll just read a purport from 11th canto, chapter 23, verse 5. And these are the words of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And this is interesting because it gives us the perspective from which we should see our own suffering. So he says, often those who give up the materialistic path and devote themselves to renunciation, we can read devotion, are attacked by impious people, persons. So this idea, okay, so that's self-explanatory. This analysis, the analysis that I've taken to Krishna consciousness and people are attacking me. This analysis, however, is superficial, since the punishment is actually the cumulative result of one's past karma. Some renunciates show lack of tolerance when presented with the remnants of their previous sins and thus are forced to enter again onto the path of impious life. This is interesting. If we do not accept that our suffering is our own, if we don't accept that, then the remnants of their previous sins, and thus are forced to enter again onto the path of impious life. That means that that rejection or that kind of abdication of responsibility leads us back onto the path of impious life. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu therefore instructs that one should become as tolerant as a tree. If a neophyte on the path of devotional service to the Lord's pure devotees is attacked by envious persons, obviously he's not talking about only physically attacked, so this idea of any way, times when we feel attacked, he must accept it as a consequence of his previous fruitive activities. One should be intelligent and avoid future unhappiness by rejecting the ethic of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. If one refuses to enter into enmity with envious men, they will automatically leave him alone. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is giving us a very clear direction as to how we should perceive our own suffering in this context. So these things, kind of like this idea of us being trained, the acceptance that within the material world we can't avoid a certain degree of suffering, and this taking responsibility for our actions and accepting these things as Krishna's blessings, were three things that really stood out to me. Conscious of time, so I'm going to read. I was thinking about what else we could say about Jayananda Prabhu, and I'm sure that you've all heard so many wonderful stories about his life. So I thought I would say something else that I read that was posted by Chandamoli Maharaj. And this was actually a letter from a devotee called Kalindi Devi from Colorado in the U.S., and it's dated August 6, 2007. So I don't want to read the whole thing, so I just read some excerpts from it. And it's a really wonderful story. So this is 2007. Jayananda Prabhu left his body in 1977, I think it was. 77, right? So 77. So this is, 30 years after that passing. So Kalindi Devi is she was a nurse in a hospice. So she says, it's a small 10-bed hospice facility. On this particular morning, I was caring for a woman called Jane, who had been with us for almost a week. Sorry, just to be clear, I'm not reading this word for word. I've just put it together for the sake of making it clear. She was a kind and polite person, and I enjoyed the time I had spent with her on her previous days. Around 8 a.m. on August 6, 2007, I entered her room and found that she was getting closer to leaving her body. I took this opportunity to sing the Maha Mantra one last time when she received her final bath. Hospice staff called her family. When I finished with her care, I spoke with some family members. Jane's grandson approached me to thank me. He then pointed at his forehead, pointed out my tilak, and asked if I was a Hare Krishna. I smiled and said that I am a devotee of Krishna. He said, "Well, then you must know my uncle, Jayananda." I asked, "The Jayananda?" He said, "Yes." He told me how his uncle had built the carts we use in festivals. He then went to inform his mother, Ganel, Jayananda Prabhu's sister. She said she was so happy that a Krishna devotee had cared for her mother. The whole family expressed that it meant so much to them. Ganel kept saying that she couldn't believe that I was a Hare Krishna. Ganel's daughter, also named Jane after her grandmother, mentioned that she remembers Jayananda making really great Indian food, offering it to God, and the family sitting on the floor and eating it. She remembers his robes and how happy he was. She said that he had been depressed before meeting the devotees. They told me Jayananda was always so kind. Even as a child, he never spoke badly of others. His saintly qualities shine through even as a child. Once, he spent hours on a family vacation at the beach, picking ticks and flies off a homeless dog because he couldn't stand to watch its suffering. So, Jayananda Prabhu ki jai. So, incredible life. Can't even, for to speak of his own suffering that he went through, he can't even tolerate the suffering of a homeless dog. So, obviously, that's a level of realization which, well, it's beyond me at least. So, but wonderful for us to hear. And we can see that the effect that the life of a pure devotee has generations after their leaving the planet, just by his potency, just see the fortune that his mother received, which, you know, who can receive that? So anyway, something a little bit on hope, it was relevant to the text, and the context of the notion and how to understand the suffering both of ourselves and of pure devotees. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.